plugged in, but we don't hear nothing, do we? That's all right there, isn't
yeah.
it? Well, do you think that there's the outlet is wrong there? No, it can't be because this is going to fill it out.
Nothing is recording.
When I do that, Dave. Now, see if it does now. Yeah, now we're recording. We're definitely recording right now. No question at all about that.
All right, this thing had to be. Was not in all the way.
Yes, it was in all the way, Dave.
Not,
yes, see, it's recording now.
I just want to show you.
Yeah.
So that, go ahead.
Well, Dave and Mr. President, will you take these five one by one, some of the things that you would like to say about them, and
then we'll refine them.
Yeah.
The presiding officer at this meeting is the Honorable Adlai Stevenson, who is the former governor of Illinois and twice the nominee of the Democratic Party for president. He's a very fine man, was a great governor of Illinois, and has had a great deal of experience politically. And I sincerely hope that that experience has done him a lot of good.
All right, Mr. President. Now, let's start with Senator Kennedy.
Senator Kennedy is the young senator from Massachusetts, a very able senator, and one that seems to be very well liked in the Senate. He's had some very important political experiences, particularly with regard to the labor situation. His residence is Massachusetts, which is rather far east for the Middle West, but if he keeps on displaying his abilities, I'm very sure that he will receive the consideration that he deserves at the convention.
What about Senator Humphrey?
Senator Humphrey is one of the ablest liberal senators in the Senate. He's been to Russia. He's been around over the country in a great many places. He has a very wonderful intelligence, a keen intelligence. He seems to understand the conditions with which the country is faced, and he lives in Minnesota, which is rather far north. For those of us in the Middle West and the far south, complete consideration as a president of the United States, but you never can tell what may develop. I think I proved that in 48.
What about Stu Symington?
He's another governor of California.
That's right.
Pat Brown.
Pat Brown is the able governor of California. I like him very much. He seems to understand the whole political situation and what it's all about. He was Attorney General of California for quite some time and was overwhelmingly elected to be governor of that great state. He's doing a wonderful job as governor of California. I've had several interviews with him, and I think he understands the political situation better than anybody that I've met for a long time. But California is in the same situation that Minnesota and Massachusetts are. They're on the borders of the United States, and the great voting center is in the middle of that great country.
Now we're getting to Mr. Symington.
The senator from Missouri, the Honorable Stuart Symington, is a personal friend of mine. He liquidated the surplus property that was left over after World War II, some $40 billion of it, and did a very able job of it with no breath of scandal. He then liquidated the Reconstruction Finance Corporation at my suggestion, and I finally made him Secretary for Air, in which he served very efficiently. He's a senator from my state, and it's rather embarrassing for me to tell you just exactly all his qualifications and what he might do under circumstances with which we're now faced. I like him very much as I do all the other members of this organization of presidential candidates, which I have named. And at the convention, I think that the Democrats will have a chance to select the man who's best qualified to be president, and that's what we are going to be forced to do if we expect to win this next election.
Well, isn't it going to be rather difficult for you as a former president not to incline just a little bit to one or the other, because you are in a unique position of being able to mark the paper to that very high office on the basis of experience?
Well, here is a situation that will have a great effect on these things. The delegation from Massachusetts nationally will be for Mr. Kennedy. The delegation from Minnesota, with its able and distinguished governor, will be nationally for Senator Humphrey. The delegation from Michigan, with its two very good United States Democratic senators, will be undoubtedly for the governor of Michigan, who has been elected four or five or six times as governor of that great state, and who's turned it from a Republican backward-looking state to a Democratic forward-looking state. That same thing will happen with regard to the other candidates who are up for consideration. Stuart Symington comes from Missouri and is a United States Senator from Missouri. He occupies a seat which I occupied in the Congress of the United States. Now, you'll have to draw your own conclusions as to what my inclinations might be when the time comes for an announcement.
But at any rate, you are going to make an announcement before the convention meets, are you?
I hope to be able to make an announcement before the convention meets, unless some difficult situation should arise, such as asking me to make a keynote speech at the convention, in which case I couldn't announce for anybody.
Do you still feel that the three principal barriers or considerations in connection with a candidate for the presidency, religion, geography, and national origin, should continue to have any weight in the choice of a candidate for office?
No, I do not. But that, I don't have anything to do with setting that out. It has weight in the selecting of a candidate for office, and there's no way to overcome it. That's been the case ever since the first Democratic convention was held in Baltimore, Maryland.
Well, Mr. President, on a statement, have you got anything further in this area? Can we go on now with material for the book
on the same
basis that everything you say, of course, will be checked by?
Well, this becomes tape 15, then, for the...
That's right, for the record.
For the record.
Go ahead, go right ahead.
Well, now, Mr. President, if I may, I'd like to get quickly to some, go back to some personal matters, and then we can go on to other things. And you had a very important event in your life when Margaret married. Would you mind talking a little bit at length, if you wish, about how your feelings were for her and the marriage and things?
Of course, I was naturally in... So was her mother, very much interested in that event, because our whole hope was for Margaret's welfare and happiness. And when she decided on the man that she had agreed to marry, both Mrs. Truman and myself were very happy and very hopeful that he'd be the sort of a man that we thought Margaret ought to have. And I may say to you that it's turned out just that way, and we are very happy with our son-in-law, and always have been ever since Margaret was married.
Did her choice come as a surprise to you? Because down through the years, from when she was even tiny, there have been so many talks about she was going to marry this man or that.
That's true, especially while we were in the White House. It was hardly a week went by that somebody wasn't set up by the newspapers as the man whom Margaret had picked for her husband. But that didn't happen. This all came about after we left the White House, and I'm just as sure as I can be that the marriage of Margaret and Clifton Daniel was one that was a love affair between both of them, and it's shown that conclusively since.
Did it come as a surprise at all to you?
Of course it did. The old man's always surprised when his daughter picks a husband.
Well, go on.
Well, Mr. President, yes. Now, you have two grandsons. That was a very exciting experience, too, wasn't it?
It certainly was, and it's one of the most wonderful that can things that can happen to grandparents or grandchildren. These two young men seem to be perfectly happy and healthy, and seem to be full of vim and vigor, and I'm very sure that when they come out to visit us this coming Christmas time, that we'll have one of the best times we've ever had in our lives.
Well, Mr. President, may I ask this? You have frequently spoken about the problems of children of the president and the grandchildren. Can you give us a little bit of a lengthy story about what you recall about the children of the past presidents and the problems they face?
Well, the children of presidents, the children of rulers of any country, are always in a severe limelight. And it's very, very difficult for them, and it's difficult for any president's family, making a difference whether it's to the third and fourth degree related. My brother had four boys and a daughter, and my sister was a very strong part of the family. She never married because she stayed with her mother until her mother died at 94. But all those members of my family were continually in the limelight, and the limelight was aimed at them for the purpose of finding something wrong, not something right. They never found anything wrong. They never in the world did a single member of my family, nor did a single member of Mrs. Truman's family in any way ever embarrass me as President of the United States. It's a very difficult role for their relatives of the first degree or the second or fourth degree to live after a member of the family becomes the head of the government of the United States, on which the strongest limelight in the world is cast. But I'm as lucky as a man can be. Not a single one of my family ever caused me the slightest embarrassment. But it must have been a terrific strain on all of them, because it didn't make any difference what they did. No matter if they just turned around on the street, why, some reporter had something to say about it. But they never did in any way cause me the slightest embarrassment. They never did anything that I thought was wrong. And I'm as happy as I can be about that. And I think that's a record compared with some of the administrations which have been in the White House of the United States.
Can you cite some examples of difficulties which others have had?
Well, a great many of the presidents had no really close relatives or had no children. But those that did have children always had some serious difficulty. The one that comes to mind particularly is John Tyler, who had two sets of children. He had seven children by his first wife and seven by his second wife. All wonderful people. But those two sets of children didn't get along. Some of the second sets were still living in Washington when I was there. And I was acquainted with a couple of them. And they told me very frankly that they didn't care much for the first set of their father's children, and that things were not exactly as they should have been in that part of the family. It wasn't true, but that's the way families operate as they go along. Now, the son of Millard Fillmore burned all his papers. Why, I don't know. The son of Abraham Lincoln, Robert Lincoln, who was the president of the Pullman Company, was discovered in New Hampshire by Nicholas Murray Butler, burning his father's papers. I've come to the conclusion that Fillmore's son and the son of Abraham Lincoln were rather ashamed of the origin of their fathers, and they want to be sure that the things that didn't show that they were aristocrat to begin with were destroyed. That's my own opinion. It doesn't amount to anything at all, but that's what really happened. General Grant had some children who behaved remarkably well. You never heard of any sort of a maneuver of any of Grant's children doing anything that was wrong. Grover Cleveland had three children, I think, but the son of Grover Cleveland decided that his father didn't know the right road in politics, and he became a strong old-line Republican and a lawyer in Baltimore. I think maybe he's still alive. But he was, I think, very much ashamed of his father's career as a Democratic president of the United States, and that's too bad. Theodore Roosevelt had a number of children, all of them fine people. It never caused him any embarrassment at all. He had a daughter by his first wife, then he had several sons and other children. I think he had six children altogether. And one of those sons was killed in the war, First World War, over in France. They always acted honorably by the reputation of their father, and they're still doing that. I'm acquainted with Theodore Roosevelt Jr. and some of his children, and they're just the finest people you want to meet. Woodrow Wilson had three daughters. One of his daughters is the mother of the dean of the Washington Cathedral. They're the finest kind of people. I don't think any of Wilson's daughters ever caused him any embarrassment whatever. The Roosevelt family is still alive, and they have to speak for themselves. In fact, I think Jimmy Roosevelt, the oldest son, has written a book on the subject, and they tell me it's a very interesting document. And I don't know anything about the inside workings of the Roosevelt family. I liked them all. I knew every one of them personally. Only one of them went off the reservation. John turned out to be a Republican, came to Independence one time, made a Republican speech to 35 people. He didn't attain anything, but I think that was on account of his marital connections, and I never held it against him. And at the present time, there is one son of the White House now, and he's a very fine man, John Roosevelt. He has behaved remarkably well, just as my family did, and I feel very happy that that's the case, because...
Who is this, Mr. President?
John Roosevelt. No. Or John Eisenhower.
John Eisenhower.
John Eisenhower has behaved himself perfectly, and it's a great asset to a man in the White House when his family cause him no embarrassment.
Now, the reverse of the medal, Mr. President, what handicaps do you think the children or descendants of presidents have?
They have this handicap. They can't do anything without being in the public eye. They can't do as they please. They can't have their marital relations without frontline, headline pages about it. They can't go into any kind of business unless they're accused of having promoted the position which their relative had in the White House. It's a very, very difficult situation, and my sympathies are with them always.
And of course, many of them always are compared to the presidents frequently.
Well, naturally, that's customary, but then I must always remember that in the selection of a president or the ruler of any country, there is difficulty to find the man able and capable of doing the job. We've had great presidents, we've had presidents who were not so great, we've had presidents who didn't care whether they were presidents or not, and we also are expected to have that situation to continue because we are free government. That's true of governors, that's true of senators. If you go through the list of the senators of the United States, there have been a great many of them, you'll find very few of them who were outstanding. Most of them were just the ordinary run of people, as it should be in a republic. And it shouldn't be the custom of the publicity agents of the country to try to compare the children of a president with the president, because they don't have the opportunity, and there's very little chance of their ever having it. Been only two families in which two members of that family were president of the United States. That's the Adams family and the Harrison family. And people were not as happy as they should have been with the successors. But that's part of the setup in this republic of ours. And the worst thing about the presidency is in some instances where mud has been thrown at the president's wife. I don't think there was anyone in the whole history of the country as unmercifully persecuted as Mrs. Abraham Lincoln, and she didn't deserve it. Other presidents' wives have had mud thrown at them, but they take the general run of the president's wives. They've been much more carefully treated and much more respectfully treated than have the presidents themselves.
You have said sometimes a president really shouldn't have any children. Is it because of that?
Well, I've often thought that those presidents that didn't have any children had less embarrassment than those that did have.
Well, now, why is it that a president has so much difficulty in deciding on a successor or in even being able to find a successor suitable to carry on the work? The
principal reason is we live in a republic, and it's not really the prerogative of the president to decide on a successor unless he wants to support a man that he thinks will carry on his program. And in a monarchy, of course, the oldest son, oldest daughter, or whoever happens to be in succession, are the ones that are under consideration. But a president, actually and theoretically, has no more right to select his successor than any other man in the government of the United States. And the convention usually takes care of that.
But you had a little difficulty in 52 finding someone suitable, and FDR had it on two different occasions. He just, there's some feeling that the reason he continued to succeed himself is because he couldn't find anyone to carry on this work that he had begun.
That may have been true. I don't know for sure whether that was true or not. But then, of course, the President of the United States is the head of the party which elected him. And he naturally has some say in the convention when it meets at the end of his term as to who shall be the nominee. But very few of them have ever had any luck in obtaining the people that they really wanted for successors. Old Jackson succeeded in nominating Martin Van Buren the first time. But after that, the convention took care of the thing on its own hook. The same thing's been true of Republican presidents. They've had very little luck in naming their successors, except in the case of Theodore Roosevelt, when he named William Howard Taft. And then when Taft didn't go along with him and he fell out with Taft, he split the Republican Party and caused the nomination and election of Woodrow Wilson, which is one of the finest things to ever happen to the country. So maybe a thing of that kind may be for the welfare of the people. You can't tell. No president can really select his successor, although most of them, when they're in control of the party machinery, try to do it. And sometimes, as was Theodore Roosevelt, they're woefully disappointed with what they've done.
Well, how do you continue the policies? We've just been through a chapter on continuity, and it begins to become very clear that any interruption, any serious rupture in the continuity of government could in these times be very harmful or even very embarrassing.
That's true, but then that shouldn't bother you at all. That's always been true in government. The successors of the Roman emperors had the same trouble. Some of them got assassinated because the people who thought they ought to be in control of the situation didn't receive what they thought they ought to have had. Same thing's been true with the monarchs in the French monarchy, which is one of the most shining examples of the continued succession. of families in control of the government of a country. They had their difficulties and finally wound up in the French Revolution. The English had the same trouble. The English, if you remember, in their succession during the early part of their monarchy, not the early part, but the middle part of their monarchy, had difficulties with Charles I and James II. They had difficulties with King John, from whom the barons enforced the Magna Carta, which is supposed to have been a free government document, but it wasn't. And you'll find that true all the way down the line. It isn't anything new. The dynasties in China, the dynasties in Egypt, show that there was always a change after a certain period because the people themselves couldn't stand what was going on by the old families.
But we have a different situation in our country now. We have gone from being a self-contained nation to where we are now, a world power, a world leader, a leader of the free peoples, etc. And it takes a special kind of experience and a special kind of a man to carry on the presidency in that sense these days.
Well, that's what a lot of people think, but I think I'm a shining example of the fact that that's not absolutely necessary. Sometimes it can be carried on by somebody who knows nothing.
Well, we're having, off the record, a rather shining example of someone who's not carrying on and doing a last-minute job at salvaging it.
No, that's not a shining example. That's a continuation of examples that have been set. Zachariah Taylor was the first professional soldier, I think, who finally stayed in the presidency. Old man Harrison didn't stay there but a month, but Zachariah Taylor stayed him a year and a half or 2 years, I think, maybe. He died in July, anyway. And then we had General Grant, who was a professional military man. He was not a success. And then we had, after Grant, Rutherford B. Hayes, who was also a general in the Federal Army in the war between the states, who was a very, very good man and tried his best to be a good president. But he was elected under a cloud because the Democrats always charged that the election was stolen, and it probably was, I don't know. Then after that, we had James A. Garfield, who was also a general in the Federal Army, and he was shot a very short time after he became president and was succeeded by Millard Fillmore. And that's right, Millard Fillmore. He was succeeded by Millard Fillmore, who was collector of the port of New York and what you might call a Republican Tammany politician. But he turned out to be a very good president. The only thing that I ever held against him was the fact that he sold all the old furniture that Jefferson and Monroe had brought over and furnished the White House with. He sold 9 van loads. I've seen the records in the White House where he had 9 van loads of furniture taken down and auctioned off for $9,000. Well, that furniture is worth about $9 million now if we could get it all back together, but that's neither here nor there. Then he was succeeded by the son of another president. His name was Benjamin Harrison. He was a grandson. He was also a general in the Federal Army. And those things come along and happen, and in spite of some of our opinions that are pessimistic, the country always comes out of it, and whenever they come to a difficult time, they usually find a man to take the place.
However, when you have talked about continuity of government, you don't mean the continuity of man or continuity necessarily of any policy of an administration. What you mean, isn't it, Mr. President, that certain parts of government just transmit easily, and that men succeeding each other should keep in touch with each other.
Yes, it's a continuity of the Constitution as it was put into effect by George Washington. It was finally continued by Abraham Lincoln and old man Jackson and Grover Cleveland. And that continuity has been remarkably well done, in spite of difficulties to which the country has gone. And I think it will continue that way. That's the reason I'm spending a lot of time trying to explain to the younger generation in the schools and colleges what they have and what they have to do to keep it. And the reason for the organization of the government under which we live. It's a remarkable thing that this government is the result of all the experience from the, oh, from way back in the beginning up to now. And when the men who sat in that Constitutional Convention, they were not old men, they call them the fathers of the government. Most of them were in their 40s. I don't think there were but two of them that were beyond 50 years old. They had studied the history of government. They knew it from the beginning. And it's very seldom that you find even a Congress with a dozen men in it who know how government originated and what its use is. But we've been exceedingly happy and lucky in the fact